I'm Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center, and welcome to the latest of our We the People Constitutional Podcast. The National Constitution Center is the only institution in America chartered by Congress to disseminate information about the U.S. Constitution on a nonpartisan basis. And this week we'll be discussing a fascinating new case that the Supreme Court just heard. It involves the diplomatic status of Jerusalem and the division of foreign policy powers between Congress and the President. Here are the facts. 12-year-old Menachem Binyamin Zivotofsky was born to American parents in Jerusalem. His parents asked the U.S. State Department to list Israel as their son's birthplace on his passport, citing the 2002 Foreign Relations Authorization Act, which requires the State Department to honor requests like this. At the time he signed the law, President George W. Bush attached a signing statement asserting that the passport statute is unconstitutional. President Barack Obama has taken the same position. This case has been to the Supreme Court before. In 2012, the court rejected the argument that the case was merely a political dispute between the executive and legislative branches. The case was sent back to the lower courts on the merit, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit ruled in favor of the president. Joining me to discuss the merits of this fascinating case and to give us their thoughts on this week's oral arguments are two of the leading scholars in the country who've weighed in forcefully on different sides of the debate. Mike Ramsey is the Hugh and Hazel Darling Foundation Professor of Law and the Director of International and Comparative Law Programs at the University of San Diego School of Law. Professor Ramsey teaches and writes in the areas of constitutional law, foreign relations law. He is a member of the Center for the Study of Constitutional Originalism, where he contributes to the center's originalism block. Eugene Kontorovich is professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law, where he teaches and writes in the areas of constitutional law, international law, and law and economics. He has written and lectured extensively about the legal aspects of the Israeli-Arab conflict and is also a contributor to the Vola Conspiracy blog. Welcome, gentlemen, and let's jump right into this fascinating case. Mike, the central question in this case is how the Constitution divides foreign policy powers among the branches of government. Tell us what the Constitution in fact says about the conduct of foreign policy, and in particular, which provisions of the Constitution authorize the President and Congress to make determinations about what place of birth should be listed on a passport.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me on this. There will be some dispute about this, but my view of it is that the president's power here comes from the grant of executive power in Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution. The executive power includes not only the power to enforce the law, but also the power to represent the United States diplomatically on the world stage. That was an understanding that was held by the framers in the 18th century, and it's one that's been pursued by presidents ever since, from George Washington on down. And this is why we understand today that the president is the chief diplomat of the United States, and that he speaks for the United States through the ambassadors that he appoints, through the ambassadors that he meets with coming from foreign countries, and through his pronouncements about United States foreign policy. So that, I think, is the source of the president's power, and is a source of the president's power to speak about the status of Jerusalem as applicable to this case. The question is, what I see as being a central question in this case, is whether that power is exclusive or not. That is, whether the power is exclusive to the president so that Congress cannot act in a way that interferes with it. And that was the position that President Bush took when he issued the signing statement, and it's a position that President Obama has carried through in this case. I think that proposition is incorrect. Although I still think the president should win this case, as I'll explain perhaps in response to a different question. But as to the powers of Congress, then, Congress also has very substantial powers in foreign affairs in the Constitution. So the idea that Congress cannot say anything about foreign affairs is a strange proposition, because Congress has very broad powers. Congress can impose trade embargoes. Congress can prohibit travel. Congress can even declare war on foreign countries. What you see is that the Constitution actually divides foreign affairs powers between the president, who has this general diplomatic power, in addition to some specific powers like receiving ambassadors and being commander-in-chief, And the Congress also has a number of powers that can be used to influence or take positions on foreign affairs as well. So contrary to what the president has principally argued here, I would stand with Alexander Hamilton, who understood the president's power and Congress's power to be concurrent rather than exclusive. And he said that in the context of the neutrality debates in 1793, when he said that the president had the power to declare neutrality. But, of course, Congress wanted to enact a different policy. They could, of course, do that. And that is my view on the what I see as the first constitutional question, that is, who has the power in foreign affairs?
Great. Thank you for that very thoughtful introductory statement. Eugene, Mike has pointed to a bunch of what he calls concurrent powers, and I'll just summarize them for our listeners because I want to stick with the text. Incidentally, I'm reading from our wonderful new National Constitution Center pocket constitution with a new introduction, and I hope listeners will write in and we can send you copies of it. So Mike pointed to Article 2 for the president's power. Section 1 says the executive power shall be vested in the president of the United States. And Section 2 of Article 2 says that the president shall have the power to appoint ambassadors and other public ministers of councils and consuls. So those were two provisions he pointed to. On the congressional side, he noted that Congress in Article 1, Section 8, has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states, and also to establish a uniform rule of naturalization, and he pointed some other powers too. What do you think of his statement? Would you add to any of the powers that Congress and the presidents have, and do you think that one power should trump the other?
So I largely agree with Professor Ramsey's characterization, and indeed I want to focus on a particular thing he said. I very much like the way he put it. It's thought that the executive's powers entail, if not exclusivity, then some primacy and certainly important role in the conduct of diplomacy with foreign countries. He is the chief diplomat, and that's an important part of his foreign relations powers. But that raises the question, is what Congress has done in this law to say that the passports of people born in Jerusalem should say Israel for place of birth, is that an act of diplomacy? And I think there's very strong arguments that it is not an act of diplomacy, and there are several reasons for this. So diplomacy is the conduct of relations with foreign countries, also includes things like recognition, determinations of sovereignty, and so forth. The place of birth line on the passport was discussed in the discovery and in the evidence part of the case. Why is the place of birth listed at all on a passport? And the government agreed and the State Department acknowledged that it was not listed in order to go around saying, to say what sovereigns we recognize, to make determinations of sovereignty over territory. It was listed for various bureaucratic purposes of identifying American nationals, and just as a way of referring to people. Just like the date of birth is not a communication necessarily to foreign countries, it's a way to know whose passport this is, principally for purposes of internal communications about Americans by the American government. And it's also the position of the State Department that listing things on the passport does not necessarily mean a recognition of sovereignty. Thus, in a separate law, Congress provided that people born in Taiwan can have Taiwan written in their passport, even though the United States does not recognize any entity known as Taiwan. So the important preliminary question before one discusses the question of concurrent powers, and I agree with Professor Ramsey that the powers over foreign relations are concurrent, the question is there anything even like a conflict here? Is the Congress trying to assert diplomatic powers? And it's quite clear that none of the consequences of this statute, of having Israel listed in the passport, entail the typical diplomatic consequences of recognition, such as sovereign immunity or other things that would follow from recognition. And this came up in oral arguments. The surest proof that this doesn't assert or in any way interfere with the executive's role in formulating foreign policy the way he sees it, is the executive can put a big stamp on the passport saying, we don't think Israel, Jerusalem is actually part of Israel. And that would be entirely valid, too. So, and one other power, while we're enumerating powers, that hasn't been mentioned is the immigration and naturalization power. Which is thought to relate to the issuance of passports. So, for example, American citizen born overseas, or someone born to American parents overseas, when they come to America, they need to have a passport demonstrating that they are, in fact, an American citizen, and thus Congress can participate in the process of issuing passports and regulate the context, the contents of passports.
Great. So the argument is well joined. Mike, as Eugene agrees with you that the president and Congress's powers are concurrent and that the president has powers over diplomatic communications because of his power to recognize ambassadors, but he says that putting Jerusalem on your passport is not a diplomatic communication. And that did indeed come up in the oral argument, and the lawyer against the U.S. government insisted that this was really just a form of self-identification, not a diplomatic communication. This prompted Justice Elena Kagan to say that it was a kind of glorified vanity license plate law. What is your position on whether or not the law requiring people to list Jerusalem on their passport is or is not a diplomatic communication, and what is that? What are the consequences for that in this case?
I'm not sure that I need to decide that question for my position. I think that there is an element of a diplomatic communication in the sense that it is on the passport, and the passport is a communication from the president to foreign countries. It's the principal role, historical role of a passport. It's in the nature of a safe conduct or a request for a safe conduct or safe treatment from the foreign sovereign. So that's what a passport's historical role is. So I think it's I'm not sure I would be comfortable saying that there is no diplomatic communication here at all. I'm not sure whether the case turns on that point or not, though. What the president's argument is, first, is that it interferes with Eugene used this phrase, and I think this is the core of the president's argument, is that the what Congress is doing here is it interferes with the president's role as a diplomat. In the oral argument, then Justice Scalia pushed back hard against that and said that there's no rule that Congress can't interfere so long as Congress is acting within its power. I think that's right. Congress can interfere with the president's diplomatic power by, for example, doing something like passing a trade embargo on a country that the president's trying to have friendly relations with. So for me, it's somewhat immaterial whether this is an interference with the president's role in diplomacy or not, because I think separation of powers entitles Congress to engage in interference if that's what Congress thinks is best. The president's remedy is to veto the law if he thinks it's inappropriate. But let me turn to where I think the disagreement between me and Eugene principally is. I am quite doubtful that Congress has a power to make this act in the first place. Congress must act pursuant to the powers given to it by the Constitution, which are principally those listed in Article 1, Section 8. And indeed, Justice Scalia, in his comment in the oral argument, prefaced it by saying that, and I'm more or less quoting here, if it is within Congress's power, what difference does it make whether it antagonizes a foreign country? Well, I agree with that statement, but I would put the most weight on the first part of it, which says if it is within Congress's power, and I am very doubtful that this is within Congress's power. It seems to me that it is not closely related at all to the regulation of foreign commerce. It is not necessary and proper to the regulation of foreign commerce, even in the sort of weak sense of necessary that has been put on that word by McCulloch versus Maryland. And I'm also very doubtful that the naturalization power that Eugene referred to will get anywhere here, because it is also not necessary to a naturalization for Congress to provide that this passport make any particular statement one way or the other about the sovereign status of Jerusalem. So I think what Congress is trying to do here is to make a statement or to allow Mr. Zivotofsky to make a statement about Jerusalem and Israel. And while I don't think that interferes with an exclusive power of the president, I don't think it arises from any of the granted powers of Congress in the first place. So that's why I would come down on the side of the president here, although this is an argument that's only made secondarily in the president's briefs, and not the one that the Solicitor General is principally focused on.
Great. Eugene, Mike has strongly posed the challenge. He says you've noted two powers in Article 1, Section 8, the power to regulate foreign commerce and the power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization, and neither of those powers can be extended to this action. What is your response?
So first of all, let me frame our debate by saying it's interesting that this is what we're debating, because the case is usually seen as a case about the executive's power. What are the limits of the executive's exclusivity in foreign affairs? And we're turning it into rather a different direction. What is the Article 1 limits on Congress's power? The same kind of question that, for example, was discussed in Sebelius, the Affordable Care Act case. I think in theory, Mike's arguments could be well taken, but on the facts, they seem to me to be precluded by the admissions and the facts as developed in the record in the trial court. So the executive says, Mike previously mentioned the historic function of passports as being a communication to foreign countries. And that indeed has been a historic function. And for most of that historic function, there was no reference to place of birth on the passport, because it's not an essential or important part of that core function. That was added in the early 20th century as part of a modernization of the passport regime. And today, the passport is much more than a communication to foreign countries. It is an integrated travel document in which, for example, on the back page, it tells you who to call if you run into trouble when you're traveling, and even such things as where you can file for your Social Security benefits. That is obviously not a communication to foreign countries who cannot collect Social Security benefits. It's a communication to American citizens. So the passport is a multifaceted product, passport book with different sections, one page of which is a communication to foreign countries. Other parts serve other functions. And as was well developed in the trial court, the functions of the place of birth are to help communications about Americans who are traveling abroad, who need to be identified for various purposes, who might run into different kinds of problems. So you want to have some identification for them. As it happens, it's place of birth and date of birth. You could imagine other identifications, Social Security number, height. They're not necessarily the best. They're not the most. I could think of a lot better ways to identify people. But once the government has said, we find this a useful way to identify people, to relate to them in a way that can help assist or deal with them as they go back and forth between America and other countries, once that point is conceded, then by the loose definition of necessary that has been adopted hundreds of years ago, 200 years ago, then clearly if it's helpful to call it one way, it could also be helpful to call it another way. And if you look, for example, at the National Bureau of Geographic Names, which is a real but obscure federal agency, if you look at the list of places called Jerusalem, there's like 20 places in the world called Jerusalem, cities called Jerusalem, in I think a dozen different countries from Brazil to other random places that you'd never imagine. So you might think that saying Jerusalem might not help, might only confuse the issue. You might think the opposite, but that's a completely discretionary judgment call, and it's hard to see that any one opinion on it is better than another, and thus Congress could say, no, we think that this is a better way to refer to people once that point has been conceded. Or they might even say, if people are being referred to, we just think it's more helpful for the whole process of travel to have them referred to, or at least some of them referred to, in a way which they don't find obnoxious. That might also help create fewer arguments with consular officials as they go back and forth. So once the point has been conceded that it is to help assist in the processing and travel of Americans, then how you do that is well within the broad parameters of necessary.
Great. Mike, Eugene has said that in practice, if not in theory, the modern passport has evolved to serve a broad function that can be considered within Congress's power to regulate foreign commerce and naturalization. What's your response to that functionalist argument? And then, moreover, I'll ask you to explain your interesting comment that this case is the most important originalist case at the Supreme Court this term. What did you mean by that? What are the original meaning and practice of executive power? Tell us about diplomatic communication and recognition, and how does that relate to your response to Eugene?
Sure. I'll take the first of those first. My response to Eugene on the purpose of the passport is I certainly agree that as a factual matter that is a function that the passport serves, the passport in general, precisely as he describes. However, I don't think that's the function that the Jerusalem provision that is at issue in Zivotofsky describes. That provision was enacted as part of the Foreign Relations Authorization Act in 2003, Section 214 of that act. And Section 214 of that act is entitled, quote, United States policy with respect to Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. It then carries on through various sections enacting various things that to express Congress's commitment to, for example, placing the United States Embassy in Israel in Jerusalem, and barring funding of publication of official government documents that did not list Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And then further on down the statute, we come to the provision that is at issue in this case. So it seems to me quite clear, just from the face of the statute, and without engaging any debates about the appropriateness of looking at the motive of the unexpressed motive of Congress, I think it's quite clear that in looking at the face of this statute, that that Congress's purpose in enacting it was not the purposes that Eugene describes, but rather to make a statement, or rather, in the case of this particular provision, to allow Zivotofsky to make a statement regarding the relationship between Jerusalem and Israel. And I think it's on that ground that we need to evaluate whether Congress is acting within its powers or not. And I think sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. And for example, I think it is within Congress's power to bar funding for the publication of official government documents that do not list Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, because that is another power of Congress we haven't mentioned, but it's a very important one. It's the appropriations power, the spending power. And Congress can use that to express its views with regard to foreign policy, even if it interferes with the president. But in this case of the line of the passport, I just don't see how to link it up to anything that that Congress is properly supposed to be doing under Article 1, Section 8. So let me turn to the second part of your question.
Actually, if please forgive me for interrupting, but that was such a good response that I want to give Eugene a chance to respond to it. What do you say,
yeah, sure,
Eugene, to Mike's claim that in practice, really, Congress was intending to interfere with the president's prerogatives?
So again, this is an argument which I think has to at least partly turn on legislative intent. And the face of the statute, I think the only thing on the face of the statute is the title, which is, I think, a thin basis for establishing legislative intent. But more importantly, this is a statute, like many other statutes, that has lots of parts which are separable and distinct. So one part is about moving the embassy. That part seems to more directly relate to sovereignty. That's one separate section. And that might help explain why, in that provision, a waiver was put in allowing the president to not apply it, because Congress understands that when it gets into those kind of things, it should perhaps give room to the president for flexibility. On the other hand, this is a separate provision, and the two provisions could have different motives, and they don't need to stand or fall together. And the fact that one has a waiver provision and the other doesn't suggests that Congress was looking at them in very different ways in terms of their foreign relations impact. More importantly, this provision also, as Mike said, to the embassy has to is supposed to be moved. and it's supposed to be moved whether American citizens who would go to the embassy want it moved or not. Whereas with the passport, people can put in Israel, or they could not put in Israel. Now, when there's a definite congressional view on sovereignty, it's usually not multiple choice, or usually not left to the election of the passport holder. There are some exceptions, but that's not the typical way. If you want to show that you're recognizing sovereignty, to leave it up to the election of the passport holder would not be the standard way. So I think the argument from congressional intent is a serious one. I think that's the one of the best arguments on the part of the executive. But the evidence on intent is not one-sided. It goes different ways. And most of the evidence about intent is drawn from a separate section of the same statute.
Great. Mike, let's go back then to the question about originalism. Why do you believe that this is the most important originalist case at the Supreme Court this term? And what are the original meaning and practice of executive power? Tell us about the case.
Well, I must point out to start with that you're quoting me from my blog there, and I was making the somewhat flip comment that there aren't a lot of cases this term that are of originalism interest. So this one is it's a fairly low bar this term compared to, for example, last term when we had the recess appointments case and the chemical weapons convention case that were very important structural separation of powers cases with a lot of history and originalism in them. But with that disclaimer, let me say I do stand by the proposition that this is an important case about the Constitution structure and its original understanding. And the reason is because, although in the debate between myself and Eugene, I think I'm right, and I'm not moved by his response, but ultimately I don't think it matters all that much which of us is right on the point that we've been arguing about. What I think matters very much about this case is they did not reach the conclusion that the president has an exclusive power here. And that ties back to the points I made at the outset of our discussion, that the idea of a wide-ranging exclusive presidential power in foreign affairs is not something that has roots in the founding era. As I mentioned, Hamilton, who was the premier advocate of executive power in the founding era, did not take that view. And it was rather something that was invented by the United States Supreme Court in the 1930s in a case called United States versus Curtis Wright, which has been widely discredited in terms of its reliance on the founding era. So a resurrection of that idea of exclusive power, I think, is quite dangerous. And it's dangerous not because what it would mean for this case, but what it might mean for other cases where Congress more clearly has, where Congress is more clearly acting in the core of its granted power, for example, the commerce power. Suppose Congress did, in the hypothetical I suggested, impose trade sanctions on a country that the president was attempting to establish good relations with, but which Congress thought the best way to proceed was to isolate it from the world trading system. Would we then be in a position to argue that notwithstanding Congress's operation well within an obvious granted power in Article 1, Section 8, that some exclusive presidential power over the management of foreign affairs, or as they said in the Curtis Wright case, the ability to speak with one voice in foreign affairs, would somehow render unconstitutional Congress's act under its clearly granted commerce power. And the idea that this case, the Zivotofsky case, could be a stepping stone to a result of that type is what I see as being extremely important and also quite threatening to the basic understanding of separation of powers that's represented by the Constitution.
Great. Eugene, please feel free to respond to Mike's originalist claim, if you like, that the framers did not believe the president's power was exclusive. I know you both think that the president and Congress have concurrent power.
We're in agreement on that, but I think that this case, if it's decided in favor of the government, could raise concerns similar to the kind Mike described, but in the opposite direction. So take another free trade hypothetical. Instead of sanctions, imagine that, take another foreign trade hypothetical. Imagine that if instead of sanctions, Congress makes a free trade treaty with a particular country, and that country has a very big widget industry in its Ruritania region. Now, the American widget producers complain to the president, who's already signed this, and says, this is going to be destructive to the American widget industry, this free trade agreement that includes the region of Ruritania. And the president says, okay, I know what I'll do. I'm going to say, I don't recognize Ruritania as being part of country X. And so the free trade agreement that has been duly signed into law won't apply that. Won't apply that. And by denying recognition to regions, the president would be able to eliminate or suspend the effect of duly enacted statutes. That seems another potential form of mischief, which could be just as great. Or the president could take it in another direction. Let's say Congress declares war on North Vietnam. The president could say, you know, the way I see it, Laos is within the borders of North Vietnam, and I will take this as a declaration of war on whatever I decide to call North Vietnam. Now, again, all of these examples assume that Congress is using a valid exercise of the enumerated powers. And I think what Mike would say is, well, this case is different because there is no valid use of Article I powers. I'd be surprised if the court chooses to make this an occasion to narrowly interpret the necessary and proper clause. That would entail an interesting coalition of the court, and I don't think it's the way this case has been conceived of thus far. On the other hand, it would be an interesting coalition to see.
Excellent. All right, it's time, gentlemen, for predictions. The court appeared at oral argument to divide along familiar lines, with Justices Roberts, Alito, and Scalia expressing support for Congress's authority, and Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan defending the executive's priority. First of all, Mike, why was that division the case? In cases like the health care case, we see the conservatives arguing for constraining Congress's power. And in cases like the Guantanamo cases, it's the liberals who want to constrain the executive. So why did the court seem to be dividing that way? And which way, of course, will Justice Kennedy vote if he is, in fact, the swing justice?
Well, I'm not a good predictor of what the Supreme Court's going to do or what's going on in their mind. So you take that with a very large caveat. But I think that the argument that I've been resting on here, which is that Congress is acting outside of its enumerated power, is not one that's been strongly pressed, and so I think it isn't getting the sort of traction that a similar argument had in the healthcare case, for example, and that the conservative justices may simply be reacting to the idea of excessive claims of exclusivity by the president in an attempt to maintain a balanced separation of powers, which I do think is something that means a lot to not just conservatives, but people who look closely at the Constitution's original meaning and purpose in creating the different branches. And I think, in fact, it's an echo to some extent of the recess appointments case from last year, when you had the four justices generally conceived of as conservative taking the position that the president's recess appointments powers were quite limited in order to maintain a balance between the Congress and the president. It's not necessarily a conservative position, but it is a strong pro-separation of powers provision. And that I think, was maybe what's motivating them. Why the other justices are seem more strongly in the president's camp here, I don't know, but perhaps it is the sense that the president is best situated to carry on foreign affairs, and that Congress is a blunt instrument at best in foreign affairs, and so perhaps should be kept out. As to a prediction, well, I'm stealing a little bit from what Eugene has written about this, but I think that that Justice Kennedy's suggestion that perhaps this whole thing can be finessed by simply having some sort of a disclaimer that the statement about the place of birth doesn't represent any official U.S. policy might be an attractive compromise to justices who are inclined to compromise.
Sounds great. Eugene, tell us more about that prediction of compromise for Justice Kennedy, and, Anything else you'd like to add about the way you expect the justices will divide and why they seem to be dividing along the lines that they are?
So I'm not entirely sure I understand the position of the liberal justices to the extent that much of the questioning was of the tenor that how can we force the executive to do this when the executive is coming and telling us that this is going to create huge problems in the world that he'll have to deal with. Countries will get angry. I know that in the first round of oral arguments, when this was first in the Supreme Court in 2011, Justice Sotomayor said, you know, there might be war. And that's quite a thing for the court to force upon the president. I would not even contrast that so much with the positions in the healthcare case as the positions in the series of Guantanamo Bay cases, in which the court did not mind overcoming many strong assertions by the executive that interfering with the regime established in Guantanamo Bay was going to create lots of international problems. Where do you send these people? How do you conduct this war, which is surely an important part of foreign relations? And the court said, don't worry, everything will be okay. So, and they seem to have been, you know, at least partially right, that the parade of horribles invoked by President Bush did not come to materialize. So it's not clear why there's a greater credence to the parade of horribles here. I think it looks like it's going to be a close case. It's very hard to predict. I agree that the disclaimer compromise seems quite likely. And what makes it particularly likely is that it doesn't break so much new ground. That's what the executive did in response to the Taiwan passport law, and China issued a diplomatic protest, and everything has been okay ever since. So that idea didn't come out of thin air. It came out from the executive's own response and treatment of the Taiwan passport. So I do think that the decision is most likely to rest on grounds much narrower than either the big versions of recognition and exclusive executive power, or what we've talked about today, the extent of Congress's Article I power and the scope of the necessary proper clause. I think the most likely ruling will be, I don't know which way it will go, but it will be technical and narrow and based really saying what the statute really says. It doesn't really say it's recognition or something similarly narrow. On the other side, let me just stress for the audience what we already know is not going to be part of the ruling. So this is not a ruling about whether Jerusalem is or is not in Israel. As a matter of law, as a matter of fact, already in the previous version of this case, the last time it was in the Supreme Court, when the Supreme Court decided it wasn't a political question, what that means is that the resolution of this question does not require the court to say whether Jerusalem is or is not in Israel. Right? If the court had to make its own determination, is Jerusalem in Israel, is Jerusalem not in Israel, they would probably have to say, well, who are we? We're just the Supreme Court. We don't know where anything is, and we don't know who's sovereign over anything. By ruling that it's not a political question, one thing they have made clear is this is not about the status of Jerusalem. It is either about the interpretation of statutes or the interpretation of the Constitution of the United States as it bears on the powers of the political branches.
Wonderful. All right, gentlemen, it's time for closing arguments. Mike, Justice Kagan remarked during oral arguments that history suggests that everything is a big deal with respect to the status of Jerusalem. And she went on to say, and right now Jerusalem is a tinderbox because of issues about the status of and access to particular holy sites there, and sort of everything matters, doesn't it? And my question is this case actually a big deal for foreign policy? Why should our listeners care in practice about the outcome?
Well, I don't feel that I have the expertise to answer the question as a matter of Middle Eastern politics. That's not my area of expertise, although I would say that I'm somewhat inclined to agree with Eugene that I think those statements may be a little overblown. It's not obvious to me that there would be grave consequences. I agree with Eugene that the finessing of the Taiwan-China situation, which is also a very fraught diplomatic issue, suggests that perhaps this is not as big a deal as some people might suggest. But be that as it may, even if we assume that, that it is a big deal, I think I come out with Justice Scalia here that Congress is free to make something a big deal if Congress wishes to do so. As long as Congress is acting within its granted powers, Congress can go the full distance of declaring war, which is about as big a deal as you can make anything. So if Congress can do that, I'm confident that Congress can make lesser statements that may disturb or upset countries that the president might prefer to get along with. So I guess I'm willing to accept the hypothetical that this could make a big deal, make a big disturbance in foreign relations. Although I'm skeptical that that hypothetical is actually true, but I tell my students not to fight the hypothetical, work with the hypothetical. So working with the hypothetical, I would say does not take something out of Congress's power. Simply that it might create diplomatic difficulties for the President of the United States. Congress is entitled to make that decision if it wants to, but only so long as Congress, in making that decision and acting upon it, acts within the powers that are granted to it in the text of the Constitution.
Eugene, same question to you. You've suggested that this is not a big deal for foreign policy. In what other ways does it matter, and why should our listeners care about it?
It's to the extent that the issue has been framed the way it is, I think it's potentially a big deal to the extent that it raises the question, in how I see the case, of whether the executive can avoid a statute that has been signed into law by subsequently complaining about its foreign policy effects. To the extent that that's part of the argument, I think that would be a big deal if the court decides that. I agree with Mike. That Congress can implement laws which greatly complicate the executive's life in foreign affairs. I think the suggestion by justices about Jerusalem being a tinderbox is very alarming, because I don't think Supreme Court justices should be attempting to decide cases based on what they read in the newspaper in the morning. That's, I think, well beyond their role. But this might not be what listeners want to hear. But I think the foreign policy consequences and the importance of this to the broader world are somewhat overstated. In particular, I'll take as evidence of this that no foreign government filed an amicus brief in this case, either this time or last time. And it's quite common for foreign governments to file amicus briefs in cases that they feel strongly about, or even cases that they feel something about. That's happened in many foreign relations cases. That's even happened in cases purely about internal American constitutional law, such as the death penalty. So if so many countries felt so strongly about it, it raises the question, why didn't they take an opportunity to tell that to the Supreme Court? And I think there's a reason for it. I think the reason is they want to preserve what I would call plausible deniability. That is to say, countries who do not regard Jerusalem as part of Israel and who don't want it regarded as part of Israel, it doesn't really help them much if it's the official position of the United States that Jerusalem is part of Israel. So if the court holds in favor of the petitioner, Zvitovsky, that he gets to put Israel on his passport, those countries are clearly going to want to say, oh, that doesn't actually mean anything. That doesn't mean America's recognized Jerusalem as part of Israel, because that would undercut some of their diplomatic arguments. So much as they might be somewhat happier if the court rules in favor of the president, if the court rules the other way, they're going to say, oh, look, there's nothing to see here. It doesn't matter. And it seems it would be, again, very much against their own diplomatic interests to attach too much of a significance to it. And that might explain why they did not pre-commit themselves to having to care afterwards by filing amicus briefs in advance. So the consequence to the larger outside world, I think, is almost nil.
Fascinating. Thank you, Mike Ramsey and Eugene Kantorovich, for a rigorous and illuminating constitutional debate. Please join us for the next of our We the People constitutional podcasts. On behalf of the National Constitution Center, I'm Jeffrey Rosen.